It's Monday morning, March 31, 1884. We're at the intersection of Main and Court Streets, Cincinnati, Ohio. A block west, vendors at the Court Street Market would typically be opening for business. Butchers, fishmongers, farmers selling produce, flower stands. The market's in the middle of the street, retail shops lining on either side. But no one is opening like normal, because this isn't a typical morning. It's eerily quiet. At the market stalls, awnings, chests, and furniture have holes from large caliber rifle rounds. Storefront windows have been shot out. The implements of ordinary business are in shambles. There's a telephone pole by the market with a hole shot clean through it, a testament to the power of gunfire that's been used here. Some shopkeepers are arriving to clean up the damage. Others are still afraid to enter the scene of battle. At Ferdinand Kinsback's pharmacy, the storefront has been eviscerated. Inside, it looks like a slaughterhouse. During the shootings, the pharmacy was turned into a triage center. Around 50 men were brought here for emergency care. At least 15 of those were carried out of this one business, dead or dying. Some of the survivors will lose limbs or have wounds that will never heal. A few blocks further west, City Hall has been turned into a military command center. Hundreds of soldiers are bivouacked on the lawn. Adjutant General Finley, the highest-ranking officer in the Ohio National Guard, is now working in unison with Cincinnati Mayor Stevens. It's nice that Stevens has shown up, because he's been missing in action for most of the weekend, leaving confusion in the chain of command. One of many factors that contributed to the astounding loss of life. East of the shot-up market, carriages have been overturned, barrels and doors, and any useful piece of nearby lumber has been plundered to form barricades around Government Square. Behind it, in the odd quiet of this Monday morning, the troops are getting lax. Some are still ready for battle, but most are starting to understand that this war, fought during peacetime in the streets of a major city, has come to an end. It's been warm for March, but the temperature is falling, and some of the soldiers shiver in the cold. Almost every member of Ohio's National Guard is either in Cincinnati or on their way, mobilized and deployed from cities, farms, and towns across the state. That's a problem for some practical reasons. The National Guard is so haphazardly funded and equipped that there aren't even enough regulation overcoats, and soldiers have to share. Some have even had to bring guns from home because there aren't enough standard-issue Springfield rifles. Behind the soldiers at court in Maine, county employees who've gotten the right credentials are allowed to pass through the barricades, and they're starting to sort through what's left. A lot of records have been saved by fireproof safes, but a lot has been lost. Local government will be in disarray for a very long time to come. The courthouse has been destroyed. The stone walls still stand, but the great iron staircase leads to the sky above. The floors have collapsed. The most respected law library in the nation has been incinerated. All the county offices are now smoldering rubble, and smoke still wafts from pockets in the walls that used to hold huge wooden beams. Behind the courthouse is a lawn. It was well manicured on Friday afternoon. Today, all the plants and saplings have been trampled. In the weeks ahead, the city will get its only revenge through a series of hangings on a scaffold that will be erected here. Behind this yard is the jail. It and everyone in it has survived, which is kind of amazing. Virtually every window in the building has been busted out. Rocks and broken glass litter the floor of the cells, where prisoners huddle up on their bunks to fight the chill. One in particular, a man who killed an entire family in cold blood, is curled up in a fetal position in the corner. But it's more out of fear than cold. The mood is sullen. Many of the men in this building just barely escaped what could have become the largest mass lynching in American history. A lot of other people, innocent people, weren't so lucky. Depending on how you count the numbers, roughly 54 people have been shot dead in the streets or are in the process of dying. Hundreds have been wounded. Many will live the rest of their lives with amputated limbs. The granite pavers on Court and Main Streets are covered in patches of dried blood this Monday morning. A cold rain is in the forecast to wash most of it away. But there's a different kind of cleansing that's already begun. Before all the pools of blood are even dry, before the courthouse stops smoking, before curfews and martial law are lifted, the people that are responsible for all this death, including a highly partisan press that manufactured fear of a non-existent crime wave, wealthy chicken hawks who stoked the flames of discontent and started a lynch mob of thousands, politicians that showed inept leadership from the governor down to the sheriff, and the National Guard commanders. They are all already busy, loosely conspiring to wash away their culpability, to wash away the truth and all the lessons that we should have learned from these events. It will be a whitewash so effective that this is the first time that the full, true story of a series of murders, trials, media rivalries, corruption, and incompetence, all leading to the largest massacre of civilians by National Guard troops in American history, has ever been told. I'm Mike Morgan, a writer, lawyer, and historian. I've also been a professor and a bunch of other things, including running a tour business. When I used to lead walking tours, I'd talk about what is typically called the courthouse riot. I love telling the story because it's fascinating, but I hated telling it because the version that I told never made much sense to me. So I started researching the events and the characters, getting deeper and deeper into the personalities, the murders, the trials, and the rivalries that all came together in a horrifically bloody crescendo. Over a decade later, the result is a book that's looking for the right publisher and this podcast.
And I'm Amy Morgan. I'm also an attorney and I enjoy history, but I'm really more of a true crime and political junkie. What I love about this story is how it combines all of these things. It's really dark, there's a lot of murder, there are a lot of aspects to this story that have really uncanny parallels to the moment that we're living in today. Parts of it are just fascinating, but parts of it also feel like a warning.
And this is season one of Truth Deferred, the National Guard Massacre.
We're going to start out with a brief introduction to Cincinnati, Ohio itself. It's an underappreciated city these days, and if you haven't been here, you should come see us sometime.
It's a nice town, but its history is what really sets Cincinnati apart from other Midwestern cities. It was established in 1788, which makes it really old for the Midwest. At its peak relevance, it was the fourth largest city in the country. Now, Amy, do you know, can you guess what the bigger three were?
I would say New York, obviously. Philadelphia, I think, would still be number two, but I have no idea what was number three.
It's kind of a trick question. Number three was Brooklyn, when it was a separate city from New York. So basically, the first two were New York, then Philly, then Cincinnati. It was the heart of America's original wine country. It's the home to the second oldest Catholic cathedral in the U.S., which sits immediately across the street from the equally impressive Plum Street Temple, which is the birthplace of Reformed Judaism. It had nationally renowned medical schools, the first large-scale music hall in the country, one of the nation's oldest symphonies and opera companies, and as part of the German Triangle, along with St. Louis and Milwaukee, it was arguably the nation's most respected brewing city. For a while, it was even considered more diverse than Manhattan. By 1884, when our story takes place, it had fallen to the eighth largest city in the U.S., but it was still culturally and politically relevant. It was still a place that was likely to produce another U.S. president. Local Cincinnati politics still mattered on the national stage, and they still helped influence national elections and policies.
In the mid-1800s, around half of the city's population was foreign-born, and immigrants from Germany, Ireland, and eastern France gave it this very European feel. These groups also contributed to a legendary drinking culture, and these traits, the people, the architecture, the world-class entertainment, caused it to be nicknamed the Paris of America.
It was mostly the nightlife that gave it that name, Paris of America. But in 1884, Victor Hugo, the legendary author of Les Mis, wrote that Cincinnati had earned the title Paris of America because of the revolutionary violence that occurred here. Hugo compared Cincinnati's courthouse to the Bastille, and he thought that the revolt that happened here was the start of a sweeping, radical change in American politics. Now, Hugo was completely wrong. But you can't be too hard on the guy, because by now, everybody else has also gotten what happened here wrong. What came to be called the courthouse riot is the largest massacre of unarmed civilians by National Guard troops in American history. You've probably never heard this story at all, and if you think you know it, I promise you that you're wrong about some very important details.
Now, if you're asking yourself, if it's such a big deal, why haven't I heard this story? Stick around, and we'll give you the full answer to that question. For now, the short answer is that the truth was covered up. This isn't some conspiracy theory. The cover-up and the rewriting of history happened out in the open. The truth was always there. People just chose to believe what they were told by their preferred news sources instead. That's just one of the ways that you may see some scary parallels to today. You might even start to wonder, could something like this happen again?
And the short answer to that question is maybe. The full answer is complicated, and we'll get to it later in this series. For now, let's stick with Cincinnati in the 1880s, and let's try to paint a picture of what made it such a vibrant place. Also, what gave it a dark, dangerous underbelly, and why people were starting to get impatient with the local justice system. We're going to begin doing that through a love story that turned into a Shakespearean tragedy.
Most people called William McHugh Red, one of those uncreative nicknames based on his dark red hair, sandy red mustache, and goatee. He was an Irish stereotype in a lot of ways. He was gregarious, likable, had a lot of friends. He was heavily dedicated to his Irish Catholic mother, who raised her kids alone after his father died shortly after Red was born. Growing up in poverty, he was a shoeshine boy as a kid, a street urchin who periodically got busted for petty crimes. As an adult, he became a stenciler, which was a house painter that specialized in the intricate, multicolor cornices at the top of Cincinnati's Italianate buildings. He was an artist at heart, not particularly well-educated, but he enjoyed writing poetry, and glimpses of McHugh make him feel like a hopeless romantic. He capped off the Irish stereotype by being an accomplished drinker. He was a hard, dependable worker, but he played just as hard, and he was a regular in dive bars throughout downtown.
Sophia McHugh was an equal combination of admirable traits and self-destructive flaws. She was a beautiful woman, voluptuous, tall, even taller than Red, who was a lean, tall man himself. She was Rubenesque, curvy in all the right ways for 19th century ideals of beauty, with a pile of blonde hair on top. She was physically blessed, but that was the only way she was blessed. She lost her father, the family breadwinner, at the age of 13. And she had to start relying on the limited ways to survive that were at her disposal. Her maiden name was Zervell, although she sometimes went by Belle Walker. And a lot about her became a self-invention, and that included her age. She told a reporter that she was 19 on the day she married Red, but she was actually around 29.
It's hard to say exactly where the tragedy of Red and Sophia McHugh started, but the way they got married definitely didn't start the marriage off on a healthy foot. The idea began with good intentions. The Society for the Promotion of Marriage was founded by ex-Cincinnati Mayor Moore and other affluent, respectable citizens who wanted to help young, financially challenged couples get married. The Society would pay for the services, the rings, the reception, buy them a little bit of furniture, and even make introductions to good employers. Ultimately, all of this would be problematic, but it started with the ceremony. To celebrate the institution of marriage, the Society was going to marry 100 couples at once in a day-long festival held at Inwood Park, a large wooded park on a hill just above downtown.
It was called a marriage picnic, and in some ways, it was a success. Held on a Sunday on a perfect, mild, 72-degree day in August, which is an almost impossibility in Cincinnati, people from all walks of life came and paid the 25-cent admission fee to promenade around the park's walkways in their Sunday best. German bands played on two raised platforms, and beer wagons made sure that nobody ran out of German lagers. Couples came by the hundreds, and so did single men and women. Romance was in the air, and people came looking for their soulmate, dancing and drinking and having a great time. Others were just drawn by the spectacle of it. Nobody had ever come to a marriage picnic before. And when this one ended in charges of lewd sexuality, fraud, graft, and eventually murder, nobody would ever attend one again.
The first problem was finding 100 interested couples. Before the event, the National Society for the Promotion of Marriage decreased expectations to 10 happy couples that had made the commitment. But by the day of the picnic, there were only 3 couples getting married. 2 young German immigrants named Louisa Dreyer and August Meyer, Miss Eliza Putoff and saloon keeper Frank Noel, and William McHugh and Sophia Zervell. Following tradition that barred the groom from seeing the bride in the hours immediately preceding the wedding, all 3 brides-to-be were quarantined in the ladies' parlor of a small hotel near the park, which did not suit Sophia. As the day of revelry went on, she grew increasingly irritated that she was being locked away. And she grew increasingly insistent that Eliza break out with her and go have some fun. But she didn't succeed, and instead she had to stew in her own boredom.
McHugh wasn't a particularly enthusiastic groom either, although he was doing a lot more drinking. When one of his closest friends advised him to back out of the wedding, he took the advice and left Inwood Park, afraid that they were about to be extremely embarrassed by losing one of their 3 remaining couples. One of the event organizers chased McHugh down, and he got him to return and commit to participating by telling him that it was all just for show, and that the marriage wouldn't even be legally binding.
But was it going to be legally binding?
Oh, 100%! This poor dumb bastard was about to get tricked into getting married. Which doesn't mean that he didn't love Sophia. They'd been living together for a while. which was not socially acceptable at the time, but not much about their relationship was. They had been in an on-again, off-again relationship for a long time. They drank together in dive bars a lot over the previous 8 or 9 years. They even got arrested together once in a raid. And she had previously given up a lucrative engagement as a wealthy man's mistress to be with McHugh, who was a broke laborer. They both made sacrifices for each other, and they both overlooked the other's foibles, like him being a drunk and her being a sex worker.
And that was more than just being one man's paid mistress. She worked the dive bars that they drank in together, and she seems to have enjoyed the vocation despite its risks. Most notably at the time, both she and McHugh were already suffering the advanced stages of syphilis.
So there were a lot of hurdles that this relationship needed to overcome, which explains why McHugh tried to flee. But when the time for the ceremony came at 8 p.m., they looked happy together. Sophia dwarfed the other two petite brides in her height, her appearance, and her presence. She started with an inexpensive dress that she'd added a bit too much lace and embellishments to, and it was so tight on her that the curvy parts seemed to test the boundaries of cotton. But she was beautiful, and even with a few drinks in her by now, Sophia was flush with nervousness and the importance and gravity of the event. McHugh was described as manly, but people also noticed the way that he treated Sophia with open tenderness. They were doting and loving. And as they took their vows on a stage, the crowd of roughly 5,000 strangers erupted in a round of cheering, whistling, and applause.
In the morning, people started dealing with the marriage picnic hangover. First, there was the outrage of parts of the religious community. After the wedding ceremonies, the aura of romance was so strong and the beer flowing so freely that a lot was claimed about what went on in the shadows of the park as the sun set. The Cincinnati Daily Gazette called the crowd promiscuous. The Chicago Daily Tribune said that the organizers should change their name to the Society for the Promotion of Licentiousness. And the Cincinnati Presbyterian Ministerial Association passed a resolution denouncing the society for desecrating the Sabbath. As the days passed, it was also learned that the gold rings given to the newlyweds were just gold-plated lead, and that the supposedly philanthropic organizers of the nonprofit event split up and pocketed the profits from the admission fees and beer sales. But in the McHugh household, the biggest dose of reality was that William McHugh realized he was truly, legally, till death do him part, married to Sophia.
Till death do them part would come sooner than expected. But in the near term, they gave things an honest try. For a while, they seemed to be a semi-conventional married couple. They were affectionate to each other, loving, and seemingly happy. McHugh was steadily employed, he paid their bills, and he helped his mother out too, and Sophia made extra income doing sewing work. They quit hanging out in the bars that they used to go to, and they moved over the Rhine, a more respectable part of town near Sophia's mother. But they both still had their faults. They both drank too much, but the biggest problem was Sophia's habit of periodically sleeping with other men for money. He knew who she was, and once or twice might have been overlooked, but he started to feel humiliated. And increasingly ugly and violent arguments began over Sophia continuing sex work on the side. These arguments got ugly. And once their neighbors overheard an argument where Red told Sophia that if it happened again, he was going to kill her.
The fights got worse. They'd been mutually abusive and physically violent, but that specifically got worse. And McHugh turned from a mostly doting husband to a physically abusive drunk during the summer of 1881. As a result, he came home one day to find himself locked out of their apartment. His clothes were in a bundle in front of the door, along with a note telling him to leave. According to McHugh, who may have been embellishing, he ran into her in the stairs. He told her, quote, "We met in friendship, let us part in friendship," unquote. They kissed, and the next to last time he saw her, they parted on civil terms.
Now, some of that story may be bullshit, but a lot of it is clearly true. He did not fly off the handle when she kicked him out. And he appears to have let her sell the furniture that came from the Society for the Promotion of Marriage. And he seems to have tried to go his separate way. But he was deeply hurt, and he was angry. He was also feeling very humiliated, particularly when Sophia went back into full-time sex work in the bars where they were regulars together, where they had mutual friends and acquaintances. And she did that while they were still legally married. Now, I'm not defending what came next, but I understand the pain and the social embarrassment that he must have been feeling. He dealt with it in the way that he knew how, which was to go on an extended bender, getting pissed drunk for at least a week.
He was undoubtedly drunk, but how drunk would become an important question. He would claim that he was blacked out for days, but that seems to have clearly been a lie. He was coherent when he bought a butcher knife at a hardware store with a blade about an inch and a half thick and 6 inches long. When the clerk asked if he wanted it wrapped up, McHugh told him no, because he expected to, quote, have occasion to use it soon.
He then started walking very purposely down towards the 6th Street Market. It was Saturday night. The market would start to wind down soon, but it was still packed with people and vendors at around 8:30, July 23, 1881. McHugh pushed himself through the sea of people. It didn't mean anything in the moment, but a witness would recall hearing McHugh say, quote, "If I don't do that, I'm a son of a bitch," unquote. And she remembered hearing a friend beside him try to stop him, tell him not to be a fool. But McHugh moved on. He also passed his mother, who also tried to speak sense into him, but she failed, screaming after him, "Come back," as he kept moving toward the absolute worst decision of his life. Sophia stood out in the crowd as always, statuesque and stunning, lit by the evening glow of torchlights from market stalls. As she was buying corn, this very simple daily task, she was startled by the sound of her husband shouting out some profanity behind her. She spun around, and seeing the raised knife, she let out a blood-curdling scream as he plunged the blade down hard and fast, sinking the entire 6-inch length of it into her chest. This part is my speculation, but in my imagination, I see them looking into each other's eyes for the final time, both of them knowing that he has just killed them both.
He immediately withdrew the blade, tossed it under a market stall, and began walking away with the same purpose and focus as he came. Sophia wheeled partly around and fell to the pavement. People rushed to help her. A woman cradled her head as several men lifted her, and they all carried her into a nearby drugstore, calling for a doctor. But no one could do anything useful. The wound was ghastly. Ironically, McHugh missed her heart, but he pierced her pulmonary artery and her lung. A river of blood followed her and pooled below her as she bled out in only a few moments, dying in extreme pain and confused fear.
McHugh walked away, but he didn't walk far. He leaned up against a saloon just a few feet from where he stabbed Sophia. His mother rushed up to him in alarm and fear and asked him if he had just killed his wife. He said that he had, placing his hands on his forehead, looking agitated and regretful, and he walked off slowly. Someone shouted out that he was the killer, but everybody was focused on Sophia, so he was able to walk to a saloon where he and Sophia used to go a lot. The one where she had started to work as a sex worker again. Nobody paid him much attention there, and he had a drink, and then he wandered off, weaving up the street. Now, McHugh is a minor character in our story, one that we're only going to mention briefly a couple more times in the episodes to follow. We're telling you this story because, well, honestly, the first reason is because it's such a romantically tragic love story to us. But more importantly, because of how his trials illustrate the public's frustration with the courts. He was arrested about a half hour after the murder, and when the arresting officers walked him back past the 6th Street Market on the way to the jail, he grew agitated, and he clearly showed that he knew exactly what he had just done.
He added to his culpability by trying to act drunker than he was, which was clearly a poorly executed attempt at laying the groundwork for a defense. Today, being drunk isn't a defense to a crime. The intent to get drunk basically substitutes for the sober intent to commit the crime that you committed while drunk.
Which is, of course, a legal fiction. Any of us who have had way too many nights having way too many drinks, know that you do a lot of really stupid stuff drunk that you'd never do sober. And because people, on average, drank a lot more in the late 1800s than they do today, juries were generally more sympathetic to that. Now, interestingly, at least to me as a briefly former criminal defense attorney, Ohio law in the late 1870s looked basically like it does today regarding premeditation. Legally, the requirement that a prosecutor show premeditation could mean, just like now, that you know what you're doing at least within the final minute or two of doing it. That's all the premeditation you need. But the way the trial courts and juries applied the law, even though the letter of it was the same, the way they applied it was different then. Back then, you could argue that you weren't legally guilty of first-degree murder, which requires premeditation, because you were so blackout drunk that you were incapable of planning anything or thinking clearly.
But McHugh's problem was that it was clear to both cops and reporters that McHugh, although a bit drunk, was in basic control of his faculties when he bought a butcher knife, told the clerk that he intended to use it, went to where he knew Sophia would be, brushed off a friend and his mother, cursed her, and plunged a knife into her. So the trial was pretty straightforward. McHugh's motive was clear. His premeditation was clear. And he committed the crime with at least half a dozen witnesses seeing the whole thing. Prosecutor Miller Outcault and his young assistant prosecutor, Will Taft, had an attentive jury and a pretty easy time of convicting William McHugh of capital murder. And yes, Will Taft is the future President of the United States and Supreme Court Justice William Howard Taft. But we'll get back to that a little later.
We're also going to get back to William H. Pugh, McHugh's lead defense attorney later, too. After he replaces Miller Outcault as Hamilton County prosecutor. But for now, it's sufficient for our story that Outcault, Will Taft, and William Pugh all did their jobs competently. Pugh put on the best defense he could. He showed that the hard-drinking but typically responsible McHugh had been on a bender for over a week. He was in bad mental health. He was also in bad physical health. There was a lot of medical misunderstanding about syphilis at this time. First, doctors believed that you could cure it with mercury, which doesn't actually do anything other than poison you. Secondly, there are three stages of the disease. And when it's left untreated properly, in between these stages, there are periods of latency when it looks like it's gone away. And this gave credence to these quack cures like mercury. Those periods of latency were treated as, oh my God, I have been cured. So, in addition to letting the jury know that McHugh believed that Sophia had given him syphilis for the second time recently after they were married, they also heard testimony about how the later stages of the disease results in physical pain and diminished mental capacity. But in the end, Red McHugh, likable and remorseful as he was, drunk as he was, and suffering from late-stage syphilis as he was also guilty of first-degree murder. That was the jury's verdict. And with a long deliberation anticipated, it only took them 20 minutes to reach it. Pugh asked the jury to be polled, the practice of asking every man on the jury, and yes, it was only men, to affirm that this is his verdict. They did, everyone. And in accordance with Ohio law, McHugh was sentenced to hang. The judge was clearly among the people who had developed a personal like and empathy for the defendant. And when he finished his death sentence with, "And may God have mercy on your soul," McHugh boldly but tearfully replied, "Amen."
William Pugh appealed the conviction, and he made a strong argument. Courts were trying to figure out how to give a defendant a fair trial when it was becoming virtually impossible to find a jury that hadn't been influenced by press coverage. We're still dealing with that today, but this was the original era of true crime infotainment, and newspapers were covering salacious criminal trials, like that of a heartbroken man stabbing his beautiful wife in a very public place, in incredible detail.
Case law at the time said that a prospective juror could serve on a jury if he had some preconceived notion of a defendant's guilt or innocence based on, quote, mere newspaper reporting, unquote. If he was also willing to put that bias aside based on the evidence at trial. But someone could not serve on a jury if he had formed an opinion of guilt or innocence based on information as specific as knowing the accused or the victim, or serving on the grand jury that indicted the person, or attending a preliminary hearing, like a coroner's inquest.
We don't do this anymore, but in addition to a grand jury investigation, which was kept secret the same as it is today, the coroner would hold a set of hearings to determine the cause of death in a homicide case. And before forensic evidence became the most important part of what a coroner did, part of the inquest was medical, but a lot of it came from eyewitnesses when they were available. So, in the case of a guy murdering his wife in a public market on a Saturday night, the coroner's inquest basically looked like a one-sided, abbreviated version of a trial.
Unlike grand jury hearings, it was public. And because newspapers were voluminous and the public's appetite for true crime coverage was extensive and profitable, you could read the equivalent of a transcript of a coroner's inquest in the newspaper. So, if attending a coroner's inquest disqualified you as a juror, and reading the transcript of a coroner's verdict disqualified you as a juror, but mere newspaper coverage didn't disqualify you, but the newspaper coverage was the equivalent of a transcript, and a juror said that he had voraciously read all of the coverage of the case and knew a one-sided version of most of the evidence that the prosecutor was going to present, but that he was also willing to keep an open mind, was he qualified to sit on a jury or not?
When faced with that exact scenario in McHugh's appeal, the Ohio Supreme Court said no. They ruled that it was improper to seat a man on the jury who, although he didn't know any of the parties and hadn't attended any of the hearings, had followed the case close enough in the newspapers that he had basically read a transcript of the coroner's inquest. The court thought that, even though the juror said he could put the information aside and rule on the evidence, he entered the trial with too much prosecutor-biased information to be a fair, objective juror.
So the Ohio Supreme Court overturned the conviction of a man who murdered his wife in cold blood in a public place because one of the jurors knew too much. From a policy standpoint, I get it. Today, media bias is still an open, fair, and important question. When does your level of exposure to news coverage in advance of a trial make you a biased juror?
But to a lot of the public, which wasn't that far removed from frontier justice, as we're going to get into in later episodes, and which was being riled up by newspapers who were competing against each other for sales that fed on who made the average person more outraged, the idea that a hanging could get delayed and a clearly guilty murderer's conviction could be overturned because a juror knew too much?
Well, when you say it like that, Amy, it sounds like it defies common sense. And a lot of the public didn't understand why McHugh got a second trial. But he did. The attorneys changed a bit. William Pugh, a Democrat, beat Miller Outcault in an election for Hamilton County prosecutor. So McHugh's lead defense attorney was now the person in charge of prosecuting him. This was an obvious conflict, so Outcault prosecuted as a lame duck, and the second chair defense attorney replaced McHugh and took over the defense. The prosecution was basically the same, but the defense learned a few things from the first trial, and it was a little more buttoned up. Public support for McHugh had also grown. He was an extremely popular, likable guy. And he spent his time in a jail cell where he hung a large photograph of the wife he murdered, writing poetry that he sold to support his elderly mother. He murdered his wife, but this guy wasn't Ted Bundy. And a growing number of people thought that, yeah, he should absolutely go to prison, but he shouldn't be executed. This even seems to have included Sophia's mother, who'd been very close to her daughter, loved her very much. But she also had empathy for McHugh, who she seems to have still considered a member of the family.
Nevertheless, even if jurors liked McHugh, and they did, he was just plain guilty as charged. For the second time, he was convicted and he was sentenced to hang. And for the second time, his defense attorneys appealed the conviction.
For a long time already, his defense lawyers, who were very competent, were working pro bono. And they were doing it because they truly genuinely liked the guy and didn't want to see him die. This time, their strongest argument to the Ohio Supreme Court was that they had tried to call a witness that would have corroborated part of McHugh's version of events about how drunk he was before the murder. And the judge didn't allow the guy to testify, ruling that it was insufficiently relevant.
And the Supreme Court said that this denied the defendant a basic, inalienable right under the state constitution to call witnesses in his own defense. So, for the second time, the court overturned the murder conviction of the clearly guilty guy who stabbed his wife in public.
And the newspapers and their readers went nuts. With sentiment growing in favor of McHugh, people becoming a lot more empathetic of him, there was a lot of speculation that he was going to go absolutely scot-free by the time his third murder trial started.
But he didn't. The testimony presented was largely the same, and for the third time, the jury found McHugh guilty of first-degree murder. They followed the law, but they seemed to feel bad about it. Following sentencing, the jurors visited McHugh, who welcomed them into his cell and told them that there were no hard feelings.
When the judge sentenced McHugh to die for the third time, he told him that he should abandon hope for another successful appeal and just make peace with God. McHugh's pro bono defense team had other ideas. They alleged a litany of errors in the trial. And the one that looked most promising to them was very similar to what had worked in the first trial. One of the jurors admitted that he had formed an opinion about the case by being an avid newspaper reader. The defense argued that this should have disqualified him.
The Supreme Court did not agree. Instead, it took the opportunity to clarify its previous ruling in the first trial. This time, they wrote that they had never intended, quote, to exclude from our juries persons of intelligence, persons who read newspapers, end quote. Fixing some of the muddle from the first trial, the court held that no juror was to be considered inherently incompetent to serve simply because he had formed an opinion of the case from any source of information other than, quote, personal knowledge of the facts, unquote.
They call this a clarification of their former ruling, but it was much more of a reversal. Even if the information was detailed, if it only came from newspapers, and even if a juror had formed an opinion before the trial based on that news coverage, it was now okay if he was willing to set that opinion aside based on the evidence at trial. This was still a balancing act with a lot of gray areas in it, but the Supreme Court, which I don't think coincidentally, is an elected body in the state of Ohio, they were clearly feeling political heat from the first two McHugh trials, and they were signaling that they were less apt to set verdicts aside simply because pretrial press coverage made it difficult to find objective jurors. What it meant for McHugh was that he was, as they say in the law, screwed. This time, the guilty verdict was going to stand. And the only thing that could save him was clemency or a pardon from the governor.
Enough people liked McHugh that this wasn't out of the question. He kept his cell and his clothes immaculate, and although he thought he had been mistreated by the press, he always welcomed reporters warmly. His aging mother had raised her kids working as a house servant, but as she got older, she had trouble working, which resulted in having trouble staying housed. She lived with friends at times, effectively homeless. She met with her son in his cell every day under the large, framed picture on the wall of Sophia. He'd weep when he'd say that he would gladly give his own life if he could bring Sophia back. And his remorse seemed genuine. His poetry wasn't very good, but people bought it because all the money went to McHugh's mom, who had become a source of public sympathy.
Everybody seemed to like him, including the guards and Sheriff Hawkins, who came to regard him as a personal friend. His lawyers not only represented him pro bono, they paid for trial expenses, including legal fees and trips to Columbus, out of their own pockets. And they also started a petition asking Governor Hoadley to commute his sentence to life in prison. Ultimately, they sent Hoadley a 53-page petition signed by 1,219 people, including prominent citizens and a former sheriff who had served as the foreman on the grand jury that indicted McHugh. He was sentenced to hang on Friday, May 2, 1884. And under ordinary circumstances, with all of this support, there's a great chance that he would have gotten the commutation by then.
But unfortunately for McHugh, circumstances did not remain ordinary between his sentencing and his scheduled execution. There was a growing anger at the justice system in Cincinnati. Yes, McHugh was guilty and he was convicted and sentenced to death. But people couldn't be blamed for asking, why the hell do we need to try a man who murders someone in a public market and get three different guilty verdicts to finally make one of them stick?
We made a lot of subtle but important changes to the justice system in the intervening years. Courts eventually adopted the concept of excusable error, meaning that even if some process was violated in a trial or in an investigation, the mistake doesn't necessarily justify reversing the conviction. Not if the court thinks that the outcome of the verdict would have been the same regardless. Now today, that idea can sometimes get taken to extremes. Back then, the concept didn't exist in its modern form. And in the goal of ensuring fair trials, appeals courts often reverse verdicts for reasons that seemed absolutely ridiculously technical and trivial. And the McHugh case was a great example. Regardless of whether he was remorseful, likable, he bought a knife and he told the clerk that he intended to murder his wife with it. He walked to a public market, past multiple people who tried to stop him, and with premeditation and intent, stabbed his wife to death in public. Who cares what one of the jurors read in a newspaper? Or whether one of the witnesses was allowed to testify that McHugh was drunk at the time he did it, when other witnesses testified to the same thing? Who cares?
McHugh's trials fed a newspaper narrative that the courts were corrupt and inept, and they were putting the public in danger by letting killers walk the streets to kill again over insignificant technicalities. McHugh didn't go free, and he wasn't the straw that broke the camel's back, but he was one of the straws on the way to getting there.
That proverbial camel's back broke on Friday, March 28, 1884, leading to the carnage that we started this episode with. A series of snowballing events, including multiple grisly murders and an increasingly histrionic press coverage, would wind up resulting in the largest massacre of civilians by National Guard troops in American history. A senseless loss of lives that, in the broad sense, I think could happen again.
What happened in Cincinnati from March 28th through the 30th in 1884 came to be called the Courthouse Riot. As the days passed after these events, fingers increasingly started to point to one lawyer named Thomas C. Campbell. Campbell was a brilliant attorney and a major political player. But for one murder, some serendipity, the hatred of a newspaper editor, the obsessive contempt of a younger lawyer named Will Taft, Campbell might have made it to the White House. Instead, by the end of our story, Campbell's political future will be ruined. William Howard Taft will be catapulted on a meteoric ascent to the presidency, and both truth and justice will be tossed onto the pile of mass casualties.
In the next episode, we're going to tell you about a murder, a couple of heavily biased newspapers, and we're going to introduce you to two warring lawyers that helped rip a city apart. Until then, we'll leave you with a morbidly fun fact. Amy, do you know why William McHugh's execution was scheduled on a Friday?
This had better not be a bad joke. No, I don't.
It is not a bad joke. Executions in this era were usually scheduled on Fridays because Friday had the opposite connotation that it does today. Most people work 6 days a week, and nobody said, "Thank God it's Friday." It was considered the bad luck day of the week. It was a dark omen, so courts thought that it was most appropriate to hang people on Fridays. Now, this is not directly related, but the number 13 was also considered a bad omen. And that combination of those two things, Friday and 13, is why Friday the 13th still gets a bad rap. That's your little useless piece of trivia for the week, Amy. That's it for now. Special thanks to Grab Bag Collab Network for their help on this podcast. And please check out grabbagcollab.com for more podcasts that we think you're really going to love. An additional thanks to our producer and director, Dan Fennessy. We will see you guys next episode.
See you next time.